Visit a farm. Log on to escapemaker.com for more ideas on local weekend getaways and day trips to orchards, farms, wineries, breweries, and more. Get out of the city and explore while also supporting your local farmers. Log on to escapemaker.com now to get inspired and make your escape through the net.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
All right. Thank you so much. Once again, you have tuned in to the Heritage Radio Network. We, of course, are coming to you from the back of Roberta's Pizza here in Bushwick, Brooklyn. You are listening to The Farm Report. I am your host, Erin Fairbanks. And we are joined in the studio by some folks all the way up from, is it Katawa? Did I say that right?
Catawba.
It sounds nicer when you say it. Catawba, Kentucky. Ronnie and Beth Drennan of Broadbent Hams. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you.
It's great to have you guys here. Catawba. All right. Now I know. So we obviously, as you guys might have guessed from the name, are going to be talking hams today. Now, Broadbent Hams in 2009 celebrated its 100th year, is that right? Producing hams and sausages and bacons. But you guys became full owners of the operation in 1999?
Yes, ma'am.
So had you been working with the group before, or how did that happen?
No, we made furniture for a living at that point.
What? And you were just like, what else could we do, babe?
The guy that was the broker for selling the business was a good friend of ours, and he came to me and told me I needed to look at this.
So you went from being a furniture maker to a ham maker.
Yes, ma'am.
So how does one kind of step into the, like, reins of a organization that at that point was going 90 years of ham making? What was your education look like? Fast, I guess.
Well, I was raised on a dairy farm. My dad cured hams when I was a kid. And so when we bought the business, we continued to have some of his farm hands that helped us cure the hams for the first few years.
All right, so you had some. You weren't coming at it from totally out of left field.
No,
you had some experience. So, what's kind of the infrastructure of a country ham business? You know, if we're looking at, curing space and office space, like, what are the kind of key pieces of, buildings of places? What are the things you need if I wanted to, like, build one today? Which I don't. Don't worry, no competition here.
Well, it would depend upon how you wanted to do it. You know, there are some country ham people that do it ambient temperature, which you take a risk.
Especially in this day and age.
Yes. Our cure room, we keep between right around 40 degrees year-round. Then after I take it out of cure, I have a room, an equalization room, that I have about 50 degrees, 45 to 50 degrees. And I'll take my hams after they come out of the cure to that room for about 3 weeks. And then I'll move them to the aging room, which we keep anywhere from 70 to 80 degrees year round. And they will just age and age. And then we will smoke them and put them back in the aging room.
So a ham operation sounds like a operation of many rooms. You're moving something from one room to the next room to the next room for differences in temperature for different amounts of times. And then it seems like, so when it's in that, like, a cure room, like, in my head, I'm imagining, like, I walk into the cure room and I'm seeing kind of stacks of ham covered in salt.
Yes, ma'am.
And then the ambient temperature room is stacks of ham that have had that salt brushed off of them? Or?
Ambient temperature would be a room that would be you would hope if they were doing it.
Oh, I'm sorry, not the ambient temperature, the 50 degrees, when I go from the 40 degree curing room to the 50 degree holding room. Or what do you call it, equalizing room?
Equalization. At that point, we have washed the salt off and put them in stocking.
With water?
With water.
Okay.
And put them in stockinettes, and we hang them on racks where they don't touch each other.
Okay.
So they hang on there. And then we move them racks around with a pallet jack.
With a pallet jack. And so then they go from that room into an aging room.
Yes, ma'am.
So how do you know they're ready to get aged?
Of course, they've been through our salt process for 38 to 42 days. They've been through the equalization room for 21 days, so they're ready to go to the aging room.
And in the aging room, are they hanging then, or are they going back to like a stack?
They're hanging.
They're hanging. And then they go from that room into the smoke.
The smoker. And then they come back to the aging room.
So why do they need to cure, then hang, then age, then smoke? Why not smoke sooner in the process?
You could smoke right out of equalization, but the hams are a little wetter at that point, and sometimes they tend to mold worse, so I just let them dry a little more before I smoke them.
And then they go into the smoker, and then they come back out, and they'll age again. So the minimum age for a country ham that you guys are producing is 6 months?
6 months.
And is there a maximum?
We have some that we've cured for chefs for a year and a half.
What happens, like, beyond that? Is there a reason that, like, after that, like, year and a half point, other than that, you're basically, like, putting, you know, your inventory, a.k.a. all of your kind of, like, money on a shelf for a year and a half already, which is a push. Is there something that happens to the product if you, like, let's say, forget about it for another 6 months?
Well, it gets a lot drier, and it depends upon the size of the ham. Some hams could hang there up to 2 years and be all right, and some couldn't because of the size. It would get so dry that it would be
more like a salt lick than a ham.
But it would just be, it would be strong. There's, you know, you could eat it still, but
right.
It would be, and some people would really like it, but it loses a lot more weight.
So when you stepped into your current role, when you guys took over the organization and the business, have you over the last, how many years? And I'm like trying to do the math in my head. It's 2016. You took over in 1990, 17 years. Have you, you've really been stewards of the curing operation, or has that evolved and changed in any way?
Of course, we kept the same recipes when we bought the business. We had ham, and we had bacon and sausage.
Mm-hmm.
And we've added some different. We did all our smoking with hickory wood. We smoked some of our bacon with apple and maple. And we've made a couple of different, a hotter sausage and a milder sausage.
You're going to the extreme. We're like, and the Americans are now like, we want it hotter and we want it milder. Like, finding the middle way. Well, so I've been familiar with your ham product from a kind of culinary standpoint for years. I mean, you guys have definitely been one of the kind of flagship operations for that kind of American country ham in the U.S. But I feel like we've gotten to know a little bit more about you in the last 9 months, ever since the fire at the Edward S. Wallace's and Sons. You know, Sam Edwards and his family have been like longtime supporters of the radio network. Suffered a catastrophic fire in January of this year. And one of the reasons I wanted to kind of go through some of the infrastructure is just to kind of set that up, that they lost everything. They lost the curing room, the equalizing room, the smokehouse, a third generation business, you know, kind of in an afternoon disappeared. And it was really a sad day for us at the network and also obviously for Sam and his family down in Virginia. But one of the things that I think has been so fascinating about kind of the aftermath of that is how the culinary industry, both kind of chefs and consumers, and then also producers like yourself, have stepped in to kind of play a role in that business. Because there's not a lot of really great country ham makers in this country anymore, is there?
There's a lot of there's a lot of country ham companies out there.
Sure.
Some of them are pretty large, and they don't want to cure as long as we do. But there's compared to other businesses, no, there's not a lot of country ham companies in this country.
Well, I think also too, just like, you know, it used to be a thing that I think every, you know, farm had a little, you know, cure room and smokehouse in the middle of their operation. And as agriculture has consolidated, you know, you lose some of those other traditions too, where folks might do it on their own are now, you know, buying out that ham. So is there like a kind of annual secret meeting of country ham makers? I mean, how in touch are you guys? Like, how do you kind of talk about, you know, things that are impacting you as ham curers kind of industry-wide? I mean, we have talked in the past on this program about the role, with Sam, about the role that the USDA and other kind of regulatory environments and the pressures that puts on the business. Do you guys have like a Country Ham Curers Association, or is it a more informal network, or, you know, how do you kind of communicate and build community as producers and also competitors, frankly?
Well, we have a Kentucky Country Ham Producers Association, and we also have a National Country Ham Association. You know, the Kentucky one is, you know, all the, most of the country ham producers in the state of Kentucky that attend these meetings, you know, we consider them a dear friend. You know, if they, mm-hmm. if they need something, they don't care to call, or if I need something, you know, they'll call me. You know, it, you know, a lot of times, you know, we are competitors, but I think we're friends first.
So when you heard about the fire at Edwards, what was kind of the chatter on the kind of telephone lines?
Oh, you know, it was sad, because that could happen to any of us at any time, you know. And we've known Sam for probably 15, 16 years, you know, and he's a great guy. And, you know, you wouldn't wish that on anybody. And, you know, everybody wanted to do, you know, what they could to help him. If there was something, you know, we could do to help Sam, you know, everybody in the business was, you know, willing to do that.
Looking to find a space. Did that mean any changes for you guys?
No. You know, it worked out that, you know, I guess, you know, Sam, there were some lot bigger companies that had more space and than we did.
Right. So just more like thinking about your kind of operation, and were there like things that you re-looked at with regards to safety protocols or insurance, or like, you know, I feel like that's like one of those things, like, you know, you kind of go into a lot of those discussions as a business and you're like, yeah, you know, I think we're covered. But then when something really happens, or even just like on a personal level, like you think you're good and then you get in a car accident and you're like, well, shit, I checked the wrong box, or I thought I was covered and I wasn't. And, you know,
but when you deal with insurance, a lot of times you find out what you think you're covered for, you're not. But we did have a talk with our insurance, you know, company, our agent, after Sam's fire.
Yeah, and check in on that. Well, one of the other things that I think, you know, we've seen a lot of leadership coming out of the Edwards operation was starting to develop a line of looking at kind of, you know, rare breed cured hams. And I'm wondering, when you think about kind of sustainability and sourcing, it's challenging as a small producer to have access to just the hams of an animal. Like, when you're thinking about where you're getting your raw ingredients from, how has your thinking in that space evolved?
Well, we had thought about doing some rare breeds, but the part of the country we lived in, there was nobody there that was raising them, no outlet. And it was odd that just about a year ago this time, in September, Patrick called us. I don't know how, where we came in connection, where he got our name, but Patrick called and wanted to know if I would be interested in some of these hams. And so we bought some in October last year. And it's just ironic, you know, before Sam had the fire, you know. So
kind of experimenting with it a little bit. Well, so yeah, full disclosure for folks, you guys have been working with Heritage Foods USA, and Patrick Martins, who's the founder of Heritage Foods, but also Heritage Radio. I'm curious, you know, because your hams take at a minimum 6 months to be ready, have you had a you have had a chance at this point to taste the difference or do some comparison? I'm wondering if you've noticed anything about the heritage breeds or rare breeds that is different from the other hams that you're working with.
The heritage breed, it has a little more fat on it. It stays moistured longer. You know, if you're eating it prosciutto style, it's still a little wet. It needs to be aged a little longer because it's not quite as lean as your more commodity hams that you buy. But we fried some, and it was great.
Yeah, but did it look different in the pan?
No, not a lot.
Not a lot.
But it was really good.
But you could
good.
Taste the difference.
Patrick really would probably say we ruined it because we fried it.
Well, I think you should eat it how you want to eat it, you know, and the product should kind of stand up to that space. You know, it's a funny thing about kind of the heritage breeds. It's like when you're looking at food production, there's like kind of everything working against them, right? Like there's less of them out there, so they're more expensive to get. They take a little bit longer to come up to size. And then so it sounds like it's kind of similar on the production side where, again, they're going to be more expensive than commodity hams. Because they're wetter, they're going to take longer to age. They're going to behave differently. That essentially require you to have a whole, you know, separate scenario to support that type of a project.
We have to keep them separated from the rest of our hams.
But then are you able to turn around and charge a premium? Because that is it's a different product. Customers are going to want that for a different reason.
We,
hopefully.
That's true, yes. Our first hams are just coming. They will be a year old in October. So we're just now starting to try to sell them. In fact,
just in time for the holiday season.
Patrick has been the first to buy some. So we will see, you know. See how they go.
Well, I'm excited. I think it's like a wonderful opportunity to kind of start telling that story to a new audience. But I also want to really say like how much, you know, I admire and understand too, the difference it makes in your operation. And like, I think that is like a really kind of a microcosm of stories in agriculture, that these things that are special or different, they cost more. Because they require more time, more effort, more attention, and hopefully all of that time, effort, and attention, and those genetics are being reflected, kind of on the plate, right? Because if it doesn't taste better, then like, it's hard to make a culinary argument for it. You're making more of a kind of environmental or breed diversity argument for it.
Right.
So you guys are up here in New York City. It's, you know, definitely not your first time. You know, you are on the like tables of some of the best restaurants in the city. I'm wondering kind of, you know, what do you guys look forward to when you're coming up to New York, or what do you go back, from trips up to New York telling your, you know, your friends about?
Well, coming from a town of 400, when you come to New York, you're sort of lost.
Well, my hometown is 2000 people. So I'm like, I'm with you in the like shift there. Anything on the agenda for this trip that you're excited about?
Well, of course, we're having the thing tonight at the Brooklyn Kitchen. And I don't really know what all Patrick has planned for us while
so
we're
you're
here.
putting us in. I would say you're in good hands. Should probably can anticipate doing a lot of meeting and greeting and eating.
Well, I can eat. That's one thing I can say.
Now down in, now I'm already forgetting how to say it, Katawa.
Katawa.
I want to tying it up, Catawba. You know, we have talked a little bit about kind of the country hams. It's like traditional to fry them up in, you said, Coke or coffee or water. What are some of the other kind of regional dishes that folks should be kind of thinking about or uses for the hams when, if folks want to go check out your website and get some to taste?
Oh, I don't know. We, like we said, we're going to eat them every meal of the day. You can eat them for breakfast, fried in the skillet. We'll eat them the same way for lunch or mm-hmm. grill them. We cook them on a grill, the thinner sliced steaks, really good on the grill, and make a great sandwich.
A sandwich, you know? Yeah.
Uh-huh. So, and then, yeah, you'll put them for a main course for your main meal. You know, we'll put them with beans and vegetables and that kind of thing, and serve them in that manner for supper. So you'll eat them all three meals of the day.
Oh, brother!
Maybe we'll take the ham hock and put it in beans or greens or
cook it overnight. Uh-huh. Have it on the side. Have it on the center of the plate, the side of the plate.
That's exactly
wherever
right.
you can put it. Spoken like a true ham salesman.
That's exactly right.
Well, Ronnie, Beth, thank you so much. It's been a real treat to get to learn a little bit more about your operation. And I am really excited when October comes around to try some of that, heritage breed country ham. So, folks, you can find out more about them. You can get your holiday orders squared away right now. You can visit them at www.broadbendhams.com or check out heritagefoodsusa.com to get a sneak peek at the special heritage breed country hams. Either way, let's make this holiday season a hammy one. hang tight. We're going to be back in just a second with the Escape Maker segment, so stay tuned for that.
Visit a farm. Log on to escapemaker.com for more ideas on local weekend getaways and day trips to orchards, farms, wineries, breweries, and more. Or come by Escape Maker's Blue Tent in Grow NYC's Green Markets and pick up a guide to local agritourism escapes to the Green Market's own farmers and producers. Have you listened to On the Road with Beer Sessions Radio? Escape Maker has teamed up with Heritage Radio to design a vacation package that provides a first-hand experience of the local flavors from some of New York's best craft beverage producers. Listen in and book your trip at escapemaker.com/heritageradio. No car? No problem. Escape Maker features plenty of ideas for car-free getaways, including discounts via Amtrak. Get out of the city and explore, while also supporting your local farmers. Log on to escapemaker.com now to get inspired and make your escape through the net.
All right, we are back. And of course, you know what time it is. Time for the Escape Maker segment. And today we're taking a trip up to Corning, New York. We are on the line with Matt Bowers of Four Fights Distillery. Matt, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So I have to start by hearing the story of your name, Four Fights Distillery. I love this.
Yeah, the name actually comes from the old Moonshiner's Gauge of Strength of the Spirits. Depending on how strong the spirits were on a level of 1 to 4, it was how many fights you were going to get into per pint that you drank.
So are you making level 1, 2, 3, or 4 strength spirits?
Level 4, which is why we named our distillery Four Fights.
So tell us, you guys are producing vodka and then moonshine and then... There was something called Cinnamoon, so I'm guessing that's like a cinnamon kind of flavored moonshine. Is that right?
It is. We started with our vodka, which is primarily corn-based with some cane sugar. Our moonshine, which is a 80% corn and malted barley mix. And the Cinnamoon is 100% corn whiskey naturally infused with cinnamon. We do have a new product, Apple Pie Moonshine, coming out shortly, as well as our first bourbon release.
Oh, wow. So you guys are kind of diversifying. Well, I want to talk a little bit about You know, how you landed on moonshine production, was that, is there like a history in the region there, or was that a personal passion? Like, how did you get into distilling that?
Moonshine we went with because it really truly is the American spirit. I'm officially bourbon by the federal government has been named the true American spirit, but everything comes back to moonshining with the prohibition days and also immigration and things like that. We wanted to make sure that we honored our heritage as distillers and Americans and incorporate that into our product line.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So how did you, I mean, have you always been interested in distilling? How'd you get into it?
Well, my wife was started by making wine at home and doing that with her friends, and I would help out and things like that. But I had the opportunity to go to Kentucky and visit a few different distilleries down there and really fell in love with the process. So I just slowly started researching it and decided to take a leap of faith and open a distillery.
So everyone out there who has a spouse or partner who is casually brewing wine in their home, beware. One day you could be the, you know, other half of a moonshine distillery with a name like Four Fights. So I think, you know, for myself and for folks who are not kind of cocktail professionals, my first question when it comes to moonshine in particular is, what do I do with it? How do I drink it? What's the best way to enjoy it?
Okay, for the straight moonshine, what we typically recommend, and this depends on the time of year and also your preferences, but it mixes really well with apple cider for just a really natural-tasting drink in the fall. Also, it makes great whiskey sours in place of a traditional barrel-aged whiskey. It allows the citrus flavors to really shine rather than having so much heavy oak come through, as well as just mixing in any other cocktail that you would use bourbon in, like a mint julep and things like that.
So you can sub out your bourbon for some moonshine. Well, so you are from Corning, New York originally, is that right?
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about the area. Why should folks come by for a visit aside from, you know, a chance to drink some delicious vodka and moonshine and soon to be bourbon?
Yes. Corning, New York is actually the home of Corning Incorporated, the glassmaker. The town pretty much steeped in history. We're right next door to Watkins Glen, which hosts Watkins Glen International Raceway and also all the Finger Lakes. We have a ton of wineries up here, and we're sprouting distilleries and breweries everywhere as well. Second to Sonoma Valley in California, our wine industry is just huge out here.
Wow.
So we really have a lot to offer in the viticulture, brewing and distilling, as well as a lot of locally produced foods and farm-fresh ingredients.
So kind of like a jack-of-all-trades, like a boozy tour of the New York region. So folks can actually come by and visit you and check out the tasting room. Can you tell us a little bit about the space?
Yeah, we're a smaller operation. We're family-owned and operated. Our distillery is only a total of about 3,300 square foot, and 2,000 of that being the actual production facility itself. About 1,300 square feet up front, we have a full tasting bar. We have our Mule Club members that come in regularly. They have their own copper mugs that are stored up on the ceiling. We are able to serve full cocktails at this time because we are operating under a Class D farm distiller's license. So we are able to host lots of nice events and really tailor our product line to the seasons.
Nice. You mentioned the farm distiller's license. How did you kind of hear about that? Was that like instrumental in deciding how you wanted to brew how you wanted to distill and what you wanted to distill?
Yeah, the farm distiller's license was huge for us because it's a much more economical entry point into the world of distilling. To go to a normal traditional commercial license is upwards towards $250,000 for the license itself.
Wow.
The farm distiller's license also really reached out to us because it forces the distiller to use at least 75% of their ingredients from New York State. And we source all of our corn, which makes up 75 to 80% of all of our products, right up the road from us, about 5 miles.
Okay, well, so yeah, it's like the kind of farm to glass beverage.
Exactly, yep.
Awesome, cool. I know that you also served in the U.S. Marine Corps, so I want to thank you for your service, Matt. Any special discounts for your fellow service members? I'll put you on the spot here.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. Any veteran is welcome to 10% off. Just bring in some sort of ID or DD-214, and we'll make sure you get a discount.
That's awesome. Well, Matt, thanks so much for taking a little bit of time out of your day to give us some backstory. If folks are not going to be up in the Corning area super soon, where else should they look for your stuff?
Right now, we are locally serving within about a 6-mile radius of us. We're up towards Bath, Minton, Ithaca, New York as well. And they can find us online at 4-5-Sicilian.com or Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter.
Awesome. Well, definitely excited to head your way to check out, you know, exactly what, like the number 4 level moonshine, where that's going to get us. I think it sounds like it's a surefire bet for a fun night.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Matt. It's been great chatting with you.
All right. Thank you.
Awesome, folks. So once again, that is 4fightsdistilling.com. Check them out up in Corning, New York, if you want to learn more. If you want to put your own kind of boozy or non-boozy tour together, visit our friends over at escapemaker.com. They will help you out. It's what they do. They're very nice. You have made it. It's done. It's over. This is the end of the episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you like what you hear, definitely helps us out a ton if you leave us a review on iTunes. Really helps other people find the show, helps us know what you want to hear more of, what you want to hear less of. You can find me on Instagram or Twitter. I'm Erin_Fairbanks. We are a 501c nonprofit, so if you believe in our work, please make a donation. Become a member. You can do that by visiting www.heritageradionetwork.org. Click on that beating heart and toss us a couple bucks. Thank you so much for listening. Stay tuned in.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.